My name is Sue Nelson and you're listening to the Food Talk Show. We've had an incredible year. An incredible year of eating and drinking while talking to fabulous guests. You can't get a better job than that, can you really? And I've spent the last couple of days with Harry, our producer, and we've gone through all our favourite moments from 2017. I think one of the highlights was our first ever Food Talk Awards, which we held at Oxo Tower in June. It brought home for me the huge range of innovations we're seeing across the food sector, from smart packaging to food logistics, food analytics, new ways of ordering, serving and cooking food, the rise of food as medicine, and the band of innovators who are trying to solve some of our most pressing social issues related to food, environment and health. The awards and the guests on our programme have really inspired me. And they've inspired me to write Food Tech UK. It's a book, obviously, and it's available on Amazon, of course. But it outlines the definition of food tech, and it's full of tiny case studies telling the stories of these unsung heroes, the huge majority of which have been on our programme. And it tells us why we need them and why we need investors to support them. So this is the first of two programmes with our favourite bits. And let's listen again in this first one to Carolyn Steele, who I'm in love with. She's so clever and so intelligent. Patricia Michelson from La Fromagerie bringing that lovely cheese into the studio. John Stapleton and John Avadik, both huge food heroes of mine. One started up the Covent Garden Soup Company and the other one started up Goo. Pippa Murray, definitely a star of the future with her brand Pip and Nut. And then, of course, the rather bonkers interview from Ali of UB40 because he'd bought out a red wine. And probably the best chocolatier in the UK, Paul A. Young. Let's hear from them again. Welcome to the show, Carolyn. Now, I think it is fair to say that you are a leading thinker on food and cities. And your book, Hungry City, I know this drives you mad because it was in 2008, nearly 10 years ago, was an international bestseller, and it did describe how food shapes cities. And I think you call yourself a food urbanist, not quite sure what that is. You've taught at Cambridge University and the London School of Economics, and you're an architect and all-round brain box generally. But food is your passion and your lens, as you like to describe it.
Well, thank you for all those lovely things you just said, and actually it doesn't drive you mad at all. I mean, in fact, I still have to pinch myself to realise that I did write a book and people actually read it, so it's wonderful to be here. And, no, I mean, I think that the weird thing that I did, as it were, was to look at a city through the lens of food, and actually it's the kind of thing that doesn't seem a very obvious thing to do until you do it, and then it seems so obvious that you wonder why you didn't do it before.
Especially in 2008. I mean, food's a real topic now, but wasn't necessarily then.
Well, that's right. And I mean, in fact, when I first had the idea in 2000, actually, and I was really just trying to humanise the urban discourse. I mean, you know, I love architects dearly, and some of my best friends are architects.
But I can feel a but coming on.
There's a slight but. Actually, the but is simply that architecture itself is so complicated that there's a tendency to sort of talk endlessly about buildings, as you might imagine. You know, they're quite complicated things. And of course, buildings are there for a reason. They're there so we can live in them, you know. But actually, there is a branch of architects who tends to think that, you know, humans kind of get in the way of the aesthetics, if you like. And I was trying to find a way of, you know, talking about architecture where actually the human was what it was really about. Of course, the irony is you can't control the food system. So so, for example, in pre-revolutionary Paris, there was a grain police headed up by the king, who was known as the Baker of Last Resort. And they you know...
That's a great term, isn't it? Baker of Last Resort.
Well, guess why he got his head chopped off?
And run out of bread.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing about Paris... Sorry, I mean, it's all it's all to do with geography, really. But, you know, the thing about Paris is that the Seine is not a navigable river, which means you can't import grain easily from overseas as London could, which is why Paris had to have a formal grain police, so-called, feeding the city, whereas London did not. London always took a sort of free trade attitude to feeding itself.
Because you couldn't control it anyway. Everybody's floating up and down the river.
Well, you didn't have to because you just let the free market do it. Okay. And in fact, you know, Adam Smith does a comparison between London and Paris, basically saying, well, one can obviously feed itself because it can just get the food in from anywhere, and the other is forced to have a centralised protectionist system. I mean, if you want to understand EU politics...
I was going to say, if you're looking at that now, and France is desperately trying to, you know, Macron's trying to... Every successive prime minister says that they're going to try... President, sorry, says that they're going to try and, you know, get them into a much more free market. And the culturally, that is so hard, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, he must be the 10th one, I think, in a row that's trying to do it. Slight exaggeration. But there isn't that... And is that just to do with food? And the river? And culture and history?
You know, you underestimate the power of these historical, cultural underpinnings at your peril. I mean, they're so powerful. And I do find it really interesting that in Britain today, I mean, you know, all the politicians said, oh, you know, sort of, well, you know, of course we can just become global free trade, you know, masters
citizens,
and, you know, just get the food in. They don't understand, or they didn't really think about food at all. How are we going to feed ourselves after Brexit? And I find that really interesting because this country has, you know, the ultimate free trade attitude to food. We've always imported food from somewhere else. And, you know, how that's going to pan out in the next 50 years is going to be really interesting because the global food system that exists now is not going to look the same at all in 50 years' time. And that's a real issue.
So, Carolyn Steele, what is your prediction then? You know, you just lined yourself right up for that one. but you know, I mean, I think one of the reasons why London, for me, is one of the most exciting food cities in the world is because of that background.
Yes.
You can eat literally every cuisine in the world, I think,
Absolutely. Here,
and good quality,
yes.
actually. How's that going to pan out then, in your view?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, when we were talking to Ben and, you know, we were sort of saying, of course, the British are sort of on one level, they're cautious, but on one level, there's this deep historical tradition of eating everyone else's food. You know, I think how it's going to pan out, I think there are major things that are going to provide a series of shocks to what is effectively a 200-year-old evolving industrial food system, which evolved in America in the 19th and 20th centuries and actually... there's a trail from the Netherlands, actually, in the 16th and 17th centuries of very highly concentrated farming techniques that then went to Britain, was responsible for the agricultural and then industrial revolutions, and then gets exported to America and really goes large with the railways in the 19th century in America. We invented this thing called cheap food that doesn't exist by externalising the true costs of food production. And we can talk a lot more about that if you like. How
we
long
will
have you
be,
got?
Don't you worry.
So we've got, what industrialisation did is it created the fantasy of cheap food. We think we don't pay much for food. And in fact, if you and I go into a shop across the road now, we will pay, you know, £2 for a chicken or something, which is completely ridiculous.
I mean, I do think, we have so many people on this show who are doing really amazing things.
Yes.
And I'm very... You know, really striving, although it's quite difficult, really striving to produce food that they feel is ethical in a particular way, you know, and source it and be local and do the, you know, all those things. And they're trying to do battle against the big, the big industrial companies. I have to tell you, I have some sympathy with the big industrialists because actually they are being pushed by the public to have cheap food and there's loads of pressure to have cheap food. And somebody's got to supply cheap food because nobody's...
That's right.
None of us want to pay, you know, the right amount.
Yes. And I mean, none of this is straightforward. And
No,
agree.
It's not straightforward.
I'm not saying all industrialists are evil.
And I don't think it's about baddies and goodies. No. I think people are being driven in the system to cut corners because it's impossible to deliver cheap food.
Yes.
It is a mirage.
But now you're opening up...
Do you think we are at a tipping point?
To answer all of your questions in turn, yes, I am optimistic. I think humans are best in a crisis, weirdly. And that's just one of those bizarre paradoxes. I think we're heading for a major, major crisis. And I think we've got to completely reassess not only how we feed ourselves, but actually how we live. And that's a good thing because actually industrialization
will respond.
Plus capitalism is destroying the planet at the moment. And I don't think it's actually delivering good life either. And I'm not saying that industrialization and capitalism together, if modified, seriously modified, can't deliver a good life for everyone. But, you know, at the moment, that's not what the system delivers. So we have to really rethink how we use the instrument of a market, what its relationship is with the state, and actually, most importantly of all, what our conception of a good life is.
Hmm. Because if it's... And quality of life.
Yes, I mean, I mean a good life in every sense. So yeah. I mean ethically, yeah. ethically sort of, you know, okay, plus good,
health,
fun,
healthily
pleasurable,
okay.
joyful, pleasurable.
Yeah.
lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And,
you know, in a way, I think what we've lost, and here is where food is such an important element of this, is the joy and pleasure that can be derived out of eating well. And historically, eating well was the core of a good life. And the irony of industrialization is it's that absolute core that it's destroyed. You know, so we're now too busy to eat. I mean, how bizarre is that?
La Fromagerie, one of my favourite places. I used to work just along Baker Street, and then I discovered Marylebone High Street, and then I discovered your shop. Well, that was it then. I was in there all the time, and the Ginger Pig, which is next door. La Fromagerie, so we're going to be talking about cheese.
Some lovely cheese, some lovely chocolate.
And very, very kindly, Patricia's bought all sorts of cheese, and she's even labelled them. Just in case I forget. Yeah, well, I was going to say, just in case I forget.
Well, there's so many wonderful different kinds of varieties and flavours and places that you can... You know, it all starts to look the same, even though it all tastes completely different. So, very excited to try some of that.
So, should we have a little taste of the... does it say Bix there that you've written?
Yes, Bix.
And what is that exactly?
That's a little triple cream cheese, and that's...
Do you boys want to have a quick... Again.
Grab a plate and dig in.
We'll have a little taste as we're going along.
Well, we should really taste. Oh, I'm going to be very naughty.
I suppose
you
should do it in the wheel. We should do it in the wheel, shouldn't we? Actually,
yeah.
You're right. Yes.
Right, we should really taste. The first one is the goat's cheese, the Bon Don Gadin, and it's from West France. And it's always good to taste a goat first.
Yeah, sorry, I should have done that.
Because it neutralises your palate and refreshes your palate as well.
And just to go through what goat's cheese is. Goat's cheese generally is a very, very young cheese. It's made quite quickly.
Yes.
Some of my favourite goat's cheeses have got that very nice slight lemon edge to them sometimes.
Yes, the acidity.
So which one's this one?
This is actually has a little bit of age to it because I like you to taste the nuttiness of it.
Thank and you get that sort of crumbliness with the goat's
and
cheese.
And I like you to taste... be able to taste the rind as well, because the rind on cheese is very important. It's probably the most important thing that you look at, or you should look at, is because the cheese ripens from the outside into the centre, not from the centre out. So what goes on the outside of a cheese is very important. You know, if you saw that with lots of very hairy moulds on it, we call it poil de chat, cat hair, you think, oh, that's been kept in too wet an atmosphere. This has got nice, close to the cheese. It's not peeling off like an orange, so you know.
I'm not used to seeing goat's cheese with that type of skin. I mean, it almost looks like you would get on a camembert or something like that in terms of its, you know,
it's a slight bloomy rind.
It's
got a little bit of ash on it as well, which you can't really see, but it all contributes to the flavour. So it's giving you a variety of flavours.
And how long would this been aged?
So we get this in after about 2 weeks. And it's been with us a further 2 weeks.
And some, to put that in context, I can't speak because I'm eating cheese. To put that in context, you know, some goat's cheese can be with you after 2 days, can't they? So this is quite an aged goat's cheese.
Because this is quite firm
compared
to some.
It's not aged, it's just...
The way they make it.
A point, you know, it's at the right level.
And how would you keep goat's cheese? Would you, because that's reasonably cold. It's not like you'd have a soft cheese, we might put it out for a little bit more. What's the best temperature?
Like today, which is great for cheese because it's dull, overcast, and it's a lot of humidity. It's not good for my hair.
It's not good for the soul, but it's good for the cheese.
It's not good for my hair. But you can keep that on the kitchen counter quite happily. If you want to keep it in, I'll tell you the biggest piece of news for you is how to keep cheese right. This is really easy, especially good cheese. So you get a Tupperware box. You line your Tupperware box with a dampened J cloth. You wrap your cheeses in waxed paper, and then you put them side by side. And then you can either put the lid on because and put it in the fridge because you're going to keep it for a few days. But if you think you're going to keep it longer, like over Christmas when you're, it's like a 10-day thing, put a couple of sugar cubes, just white, ordinary sugar cubes into the box. Okay. Close the box and then put it in the lower part or the, you know, wherever you keep the
salad drawer,
whatever. And it will keep very nicely. Take out your cheese whenever you want it. You take off the wrapping. Always put new wrapping on when you replace your cheese. You have created in that little chamber, that box, is a humidity chamber because the dampness of the cloth gives you the wetness the humidity. And then the sugar absorbs any of the odours and other things that might change the flavour of your cheese.
Now, brilliant. I have read loads and loads and loads about cheese and all sorts of things. I have never heard that is the optimum way to keep cheese.
That is pure gold. Okay, and you heard it here. But it's in my book, so if anybody wants to buy my book. But
I'm sure they do after that. When there's that much knowledge in there.
No, but it's simple things like that that help you keep your cheese properly and that you don't... you don't get disappointed because often you buy something and you can't eat the whole thing all at once and you wonder how am I going to keep it and then you find it in the back of the fridge, this horrible little
And the absolute worst thing you can do is wrap it in plastic.
Well, you can use the cut surfaces like for the Beaufort. You can cover those in a cling just to keep them from drying out. Mm-hmm. But always remember, as I said, cheese ripens from the outside in, so the crust needs to be respected. So don't over wrap that.
Respect the cheese. Sue.
Respect the cheese. I'm going to respect the cheese by moving on from my goat's cheese. I've just had goat's cheese, and again, if you are doing a tasting at home, this is what you should do. Really, is go from the least, you know.
Yeah,
sort of
we start a little journey. Yeah. So try the Bix now, because that's the little that one there.
This one. There.
It's
very soft.
It's soft and gooey.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I know. See, you were just saying, Russell, eat that, you know, if your eyes
help
first.
Yourself.
Wow. So I have never heard of this one.
Right, so it's from Nettlebed. Nettlebed cheese. Rosie. They make the most wonderful hard cheese as well, but I think the Bix is superb. Yeah.
Wow.
So different to the first one. So we're getting a real contrast here.
You know, it's near Oxford, so wonderful grazing area. Okay, so it's going to have lovely lush grass.
And this is lush cheese.
Yes, and it goes into the cheese, yeah.
But yeah, you can almost taste the freshness of it.
You can, can't you?
And it's so soft compared to the previous one, the goat's cheese. And it almost felt like picking up a runny truffle or something, like a chocolate truffle.
But absolutely.
You could make that tasty. Gorgeous. You could make that. That would make a fantastic chocolate
it's
cheese.
It's as if you can taste Oxfordshire in that cheese. Yes. It's got the heritage.
But seriously, you can. And we're not exaggerating. Mm. It does. Mm. You can almost taste the grass.
Yeah, yeah. Actually.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. Mm. And it's a small cheese. It's only about, I think, 180 grams. And so it's very, very difficult to get it to that stage. And often you'll see it in shops that's... And it's quite hard because they've kept it too cold.
And is that...
And they've not had the, you know... but we've got to... We have our own ripening rooms where we do all
make
our...
Make sure it's absolutely...
Yes, all our maturing.
And do you have different rooms for different temperatures for different cheeses?
We have four rooms.
Right, okay.
They're all interconnecting so that we don't have to keep coming in and out. So we can work in there quietly all through the day. And that one is in the goat room. It's cold, but there is a nice amount of humidity, not too much. And if it comes in too young and it needs time, we then put it into another room to start it off and then bring it into another room. We can move them around the room.
John, hi there. It's very nice to see you.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. We met a few weeks ago, didn't we, and had a good old chat. And it'll be really nice, again, to talk about all your background. And I think, for me in particular, there's a lot of companies that we have on here, all sorts of producers
food producers and things. And the magic thing for them is being able to build a brand from scratch and then sell it and be very successful in the way you have. So it's going to be great to hear your story. Little Dish is very interesting too. But do you mind just kicking off and talking about the new Covent Garden Soup Company? And just for those of people who don't really know, you didn't used to be able to, trust me, this is true, you didn't used to be able to buy
soup.
I hate that phrase. You didn't used to be able to buy soup in anything other than a tin. I think that's true to say. And then all of a sudden, one day, these cartons, almost like Tetra Pak sort of cartons, started appearing in the chilled section, you know, where the orange juice was and things like that. And it was soup, and it was like proper soup as opposed to, you know, stuff in a can and Heinz
that luminous
and Baxter's.
Orange stuff.
Oof. Yeah. And how on earth did you come up with the idea of this? And what made you do it? I mean, if you think about it, it's a completely ridiculous thing to have gone and done.
Yes, and we were completely crazy to even think of doing it.
That's where all the best ideas start, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's one of the great advantages, I think, of you know, it's almost like ignorance is bliss. If you don't really know what you're at, there's no reason not to keep doing it. And I often say, if you know how high that mountain is that you're about to climb, sometimes you kind of balk and say, oh, that's for somebody else, or that's impossible, or it's not, you know, something I can do right now. Whereas you don't really know, and we didn't really know. We were a bunch of happy amateurs getting on with it and doing something unusual. If you're halfway up the mountain before you figure out it's a big mountain, you've got to kind of carry on anyway.
Yeah, you've got no choice, have you, really? Yeah. I mean, socially, it's you know, you can't go around to people and go, oh, actually, I shouldn't really start in that. It was a mistake. You just have to sort of crack on.
And I'm sure that many of our listeners who have their own, you know, small businesses or small brands or early stage, they'll probably be very relieved to hear that, you know, it starts the same way, even when someone ends up being successful.
Well, you know, hindsight is wonderful. So you can always look back and post-rationalize all the decisions you made. But I try not to. And it's wonderful that we're feeling grown up, because certainly at the time, I didn't feel grown up.
Did you know? Okay.
No. I was straight out of university and had no idea. And I met this guy called Andrew Palmer, who had the idea, but didn't really know how to go about doing it. And we basically, very long story short, put our heads together and decided to go and implement it. And it was one big adventure, like a roller coaster adventure.
I mean, that's a huge leap of faith. Yeah. Did you really, really believe that it was going to take off? Because it was different. And I mean, it's a massive leap of faith. You've got to convince as well investors. You've got to do an amazing pitch that they're going to hold hands with you and jump over the cliff edge with you. And then that's a huge amount of belief.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we were young and naive at the time, so it's easy to have
belief. Thank goodness.
Yeah. I mean, you got to convince yourself. We were convinced, and Andrew was certainly convinced, and he convinced me, and we convinced everybody else, and we managed to convince the consumer, convince the retailer, convince investors, and then form a team around us to convince them too. And that was really important. But we did that based on, we weren't quite sure how long it was going to take to be able to capture the market.
Yeah.
And we weren't quite sure how quickly others would catch up with us or compete with us. And like I explained earlier, luckily they came in and left again. Of course, what then happened was the retailers themselves developed their own label versions, which competed with us. But frankly, once you've got the advantage of the first mover, and once you've got the premium position, you can maintain that, and you can defend that. And actually, the own label category comes in slightly beneath the brand, typically, if you're doing your work properly.
In terms of price, you mean?
In terms of price and quality and the entire proposition and the entire offer.
And the way it looks.
And then together you can grow the category much more quickly than you would if you were on your own.
Yeah.
And in fact, the own label presence in that category gives the new category credibility to the consumer. They see it's not just these weird guys in cartons. It's Tesco's are doing it, and Waitrose are doing it, and everybody else is doing it. So we all benefited from that. We had the advantage of the first 2-3 years of being on our own, making lots and lots and lots of mistakes. Luckily, in hindsight, again, none of them terminal, but we got away with a lot because we were the only fresh soup manufacturer. And once we eventually figured out what we needed to do right and perfected it, both as a manufacturing business, but as a brand building business, then we were on the right track. And that's when we attracted most of the competition, but we were ready for it, luckily.
And then when competition comes along, you can fight it out in lots of ways, can't you? You can start having a price war, or you can innovate so they're catching up with you. That's the other sort of tactic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's death to the category if you go straight into a price war. It's just a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
And I guess later in the evolution of New Covent Garden, luckily after we had sold it already, but that began to happen, and lots of promotions in the category and a lot more competition, competition on price. In the early years, we had the opportunity to, we had this big factory which was empty, so we had to
Let's experiment.
Yeah, exactly. we had to go and fill it, right? Yeah. And the best way to fill it is to make lots of soup, and lots of different types of soup. By the way, if you want to build a brand, in my estimation, in the UK or anywhere for that matter, you have to invest ahead of the curve. Yeah. You have to be able to invest and generate awareness for your brand, and you don't usually generate that sort of cash or those resources from the business. So you really have to bring in shareholders' funds to invest in building the brand. And that's what we did later with Little Dish, because we outsourced manufacturing there. But back to New Covent Garden, we had to manufacture ourselves, like I explained. We spent all the money we raised on building a very good, high-tech, sophisticated factory. No money left then to build the brand. So that was a bit of a problem for us.
Nice shiny boys' toys over there. Well, let's talk about you. So your mum and dad thought, Pippa should go to university. No idea what she's going to do with her life. I know she's going to do anthropology, geography and humanities at university. Mm. So off you trot to University College London between 2007, 2010, something like that. And there you were studying to be a, I don't know what that makes you qualified to do. What does that make you qualified to do?
The thing with anthropology, super, super interesting subject.
Really interesting.
Fascinating, loved it. But it is quite a niche degree.
What is it exactly, for anybody who doesn't know what anthropology is?
I mean, essentially, it's the study of kind of like tribes and small-scale communities, to kind of, I guess, a social science, really. Mm. You can go into all sorts of different things from that, you know, from being a museum curator right the way through to, if you want to be an actual anthropologist, everything in between. And often a lot of marketeers are anthropologists because you use...
It's the study of people, I guess.
Study of people.
Useful information.
And behaviours, people's
behaviour. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just nosy. I think that's why I like it.
And how you influence them.
But you did end up working for a museum, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I did vaguely use it. So I actually was working at the Science Museum, which was a job before, the one I quit to start Pippa Nut. So I was working as a theatre producer, but in a museum context. Which was great, and I'm not one of those people that's come from a big bank and quit their investment banking job to start their real dream. Actually, I quite like the job that I was doing.
So you're in the Science Museum, you're an anthropologist, you're trying to get kids and all sorts of people involved in understanding science and all that. 2014, I know, I'll go and make peanut butter.
I know, this is the thing that's really hard to connect the two together.
It is.
I often find the most interesting people are like that. They did something completely random, and now they do something completely other random at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's the funniest bit is telling your boss at the Science Museum that you're going to quit and start a nut butter brand. That really hits, like, you know.
I heard about this bloke who decided to leave to make cakes.
Yeah.
And what he did was he left a cake on his boss's desk and said, I've gone to make cakes, basically.
Be back, ..
Might not be back, yeah. I presume you didn't do that with your peanut butter.
No.
So you left. I can't imagine what your friends and people must have said. Mm. They must have said you were mad.
Nuts.
Pun intended.
Exactly. Mm. I mean, the thing is, when you're starting a company, you kind of, well, at least my approach was that I kind of drip-fed into it. I didn't quit my job and then just go full on into it.
Thank goodness.
Took me about 2 years to, you know, actually get the products launched. So for the first year, I was working part-time. Mm. So it wasn't like you pull the rug out of underneath you and just kind of run at it. But having said that, the conversation with my mum and dad when I first told them, I think they thought it was more like a WI project, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I also think with your product, which I eat myself, the almond butter in particular, I think with your product, it hasn't got that, you know, sometimes you get peanut butter and it sort of goes on the roof of your mouth
cloy-y.
And it's almost like, when you eat a really raw banana,
you know, that sort of does.
And it doesn't have that with yours at all. And yet it's not, because it's oily.
Mm.
So when I have the Whole Earth, is it Whole Earth peanut butter? Lovely though it is. For me, it's too oily, because that's how they get around that. But yours is roasted nuts, isn't it, with a little bit of salt. And somehow that gives it a much better texture.
Mm, I mean, we mill our nuts twice and obviously pay attention to like how much we roast them and things like that because of the flavour profile. But I think particularly when you've got a product which literally has two ingredients in it, so that one in particular, just almonds and sea salt, You kind of have to pay attention to those raw ingredients and be really specific about what you're putting in there. Same with peanuts. There are specific, all different variants that you can choose. Certain ones have different flavour profiles. So yeah, you have to pay attention to what you're putting inside it.
So with a product like that, which is just such a small list of ingredients, how does it work between batches? Like if you were to cook at a slightly higher temperature or a different part of the oven, I mean, I don't know exactly the kind of machinery that you use. Is there any kind of issue with difference in that kind of flavour profile between batches or between jars?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you always buy the same kind of raw materials and you obviously work with suppliers that you've worked with that are going to provide you with a consistent product. And then in terms of, you know, just your processing, I guess after a while you do just set processes. But yeah, you can find that sometimes the roasting grade might be a little bit higher or a little bit lower, and it will affect, like, I mean, if something's very heavily roasted, it'll be a bit more bitter, just because it almost that can like lean into being a bit burnt. But so you have to be mindful of that.
I guess you have a quality control process to make sure that if something does go a bit over or a bit under, you then it just doesn't go out the door.
Exactly, yeah.
So you basically, Science Museum, we loved it and all that, but started doing a bit of part-time peanut butter making and left in July 2014. Founded Pip and Nut in January 2015. So we're talking about only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's had the most phenomenal success. And so many people talk about you as a business, you know, a businesswoman, serious businesswoman with a really great brand, young, entrepreneurial, a bit of a role model, really.
And you've won lots of awards as
flattery,
well.
God, my hair, I won't be able to get out the door.
Well, you will do, because you just had some gin.
I'll roll out, it's fine. But yeah, no, it's been an incredible journey. I think for me, I actually have not had any business experience, no experience in food and drink.
That's what I'm saying, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a baptism of fire. And I think, I always say, like, you know, I have a great kind of mentors and investors who kind of support me, and then and now a brilliant team. And I think I always give them a lot of credit, because whilst I'm at the front and my name's in the brand, but actually they do so much work behind the scenes in terms of actually making this business what it is. But we have been really fortunate. I think lots of things play into that. I think it's hard to pin it on one exact thing, but I think it helps that we've got a really great product that's bang on trend.
Yeah.
A brand that kind of resonates with people, has that emotive feel to it. And also, you know, I think we've been lucky with that. Some buyers have really backed the brand and given us the kind of some really great kind of listings. And
But why is that? I mean, why is that exactly? Because there's hundreds of new products every day. Yeah.
And even hundreds of peanut butters. It's a big category.
And buyers are just inundated all the time. What is it that is, you know, stood out for them, where they're backing you? Actually, the buyers are quite keen. Can you pinpoint that?
So, I mean, if we talk on kind of like a bit more of a category, what's happening? I mean, the thing is, a lot of, I mean, peanut butter and nut butters, they play into like quite big macro trends that are happening in food and drink. So, for instance, sugar's a bit of the demon at the moment, being targeted. And I mean, what that happens in our category, we've got jams and honeys and marmalades, all which are pretty laden with the stuff. And don't get me wrong, I like a good jam. But it does mean that people's tastes are changing. And, you know, peanut butter's great because it's relatively low in sugar. It's high in fat, but high in protein too. And so you've got those kind of like nice health benefits, which people are looking for more products that are high in protein. So it's, you know, that kind of health trend that's running through the category is kind of really helping buyers think, actually, we've got to give more space to this product.
Yeah, but the thing with that for me is it means it's a growing sector, a growing category. But that doesn't then, you know, give you an answer of why yours has done quite so well, because there'll be hundreds of other people going, ha-ha, peanut butter, I'll make that.
Yeah. So I think on that kind of like what we're doing on a brand level that's really getting us like that traction. So for us, we do loads of things. So I think from a product point of view, we always look at innovating. So we try and play around with like flavours. Like we've got a coconut almond, you've got a honey cinnamon cashew, you know, we've got crunchy maple peanut, and that kind of surprise and delight with our flavours. We try and kind of innovate. It's quite simple. We don't make them too like experimental, but you know, those accessible, fun flavours which bring people in. And ultimately, you know, we've got simpler, you know, almond butters as well. So I think our flavour range really works for buyers.
James, can we talk to you about your new venture? Again, we're going to have a little bit of a tasting thing going on. So we've got some lovely red wine, and you've bought a little cool box, and it says Coconut Collaborative.
you're very, very experienced in the food world, and we'll talk about goo later. What is this new product about? What's it all about?
So the Coconut Collaborative is a range of yogurts and desserts that are made with coconut milk. They're totally non-dairy and surprisingly tasty. The whole world of dairy-free is changing quite rapidly at the moment, because a lot of people are, even if they're not lactose intolerant, are making a positive choice to reduce the amount of dairy. I mean, for instance, I love creamy products. I love cheese. But even people like me are going what is termed as flexitarians. So we are becoming more flexitarian. So we might say, well, you know what, on Monday and Tuesday, I'm not going to have any dairy. Anyway, so I started looking at the whole non-dairy market when I sold my last business. And I love coconut milk. It's the creamiest of the non-dairy milks. And you can get a really good, almost like a dairy taste, actually. So I started playing around making yogurts and desserts, and et voila.
We're letting you talk because we're just scoffing. Scoffing away.
But I'm going to join you.
Yes. So Jerome. So Jerome's tucked right into the chocolatey one.
No, that's the lemon one he's got.
I've got both.
No,
I've
he's eating the chocolate one already.
All right. Talking. Okay.
This chocolate is so smooth. Sorry to interrupt you, Sue.
Is it? I haven't tasted that one yet.
That's brilliant.
Jerome, just by coincidence, are you lactose intolerant?
I am.
You're
yeah.
saying. So what? You're an expert, really. So what do you? What are you thinking of the chocolate one?
I know the taste is amazing. It's very, very good, very good.
Not good, but very, very good.
It doesn't taste overly coconutty, because for a while I was dairy free, and at the moment I've cut milk out of my diet. But a lot of the products tended to be. Just they had that overwhelming coconuttiness, which maybe for some is exactly what they're after. But this is amazing.
It's interesting because it's coconut as an ingredient, not as a flavour.
Mm.
And that's different. I mean, I think a lot of people associate kind of bounty bar or coconut with bounty bars. Or
And that texture as well. But some people are a little bit frightened of that texture.
Yeah, that's true. And actually coconut, I'm not. You know, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It is quite polarizing. So some people love it and some people hate it.
Yep.
And but I think with my stuff, people are surprised that it tastes as creamy and kind of, if you like, quite rich. In fact, I use the same agency for the Coconut Collaborative as I did for goo, and they're two very different brands.
Yeah, completely.
I
mean,
incredibly different. Actually, couldn't be more polar different, could they?
I know.
Well, that's good though, because what you're doing is really thinking about the context of where these products are going to be seen.
Yes, and also the consumer. So what is my kind of bullseye target consumer into? And they're really into kind of natural products, number one. So it needs to look very natural, quite earthy and so on. Goo was a much slicker brand.
It was almost a little bit food porny, if I may say.
Yes, actually. It was. I mean, if you remember...
And it was even more risque.
And photography.
You'll probably remember that M&S chocolate pudding ad. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
which was the birth of food porn, wasn't it?
Absolutely,
it was
really,
yeah.
And I did a similar ad, and it had a similar effect. You know, it's kind of, in some ways, very easy. But you know, timing is everything in the food business. And actually, goo, because it's loaded with kind of fat and loaded with sugar, and
it's a treat. It's a treat.
Makes it a real treat. But it's something that, and it's still doing very well. And I still buy it occasionally. In fact, when I sold the business, I did negotiate that I had a lifetime supply of goo.
That's brilliant.
As part of the deal.
Okay, Jerome, so take note of this. If you sell your business, I have a lifetime supply of wine. Thank you very much.
We own some of the vines, so it's okay. We've got it on the
control. Okay. You got it.
Fantastic.
That's good. That's
very smart.
Of course, I very rarely take up my my lifetime allocation, but anyway, I think the in the last few years, people have become much more concerned about healthy products.
You'll never guess who I've got on the phone here.
Has it got anything to do with the little boogie that you were doing while we were playing the theme tune?
It was, actually, yeah. So I'm a little bit of a fan. Ali Campbell, are you there from UB40 on the end of the phone?
Yes, right here.
You are. Now, I know you're on a bit of a tour at the moment, doing wonderful songs that I love, like Red Red Wine and Rat in Me Kitchen.
Yeah.
Yes. So where are you? Where are you at the moment? Were you in Kent a couple of weeks ago?
No, last Saturday.
Last Saturday, right.
We were in Canterbury, yeah. We had 11,500 people come to see us.
My God, that's more than when you started, when you were famous.
I mean, it's the whole tour's been like that, you know. We've got, it's more like a festival than a gig. We've got the original Wailers, and we've got Raging Fire and Level 42 with us, you know. Mm. So it's a day of music.
Used to love Level 42, especially the bass. A great bass.
He's one of the best bass players in the world, in my opinion. Yeah. Mark King, he's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. The reason why you're on the Food Talk show, it may sound like a ridiculous combination here, but actually, you know, one of your most famous songs is Red Red Wine. You're collaborating with our studio guest, who we're going to talk to in a minute, to produce some Red Red Wine.
Yes. We thought it was about time. We released it round about Christmas time. We had a launch in London. And, it's like 30-odd years, you know. We've been researching it.
Well, I've looked at the bottle here. It looks fabulous. So it says...
Well, it's a Bordeaux Superior, you know. I mean, some of the best red wines in the world, you know, have come from the Bordeaux area. And... We're really proud of it, actually.
So I've got the bottle in front of me. There's a lovely label. It says UB40 on the label, from Ali, Astro and Mickey. You've even got your name on the label. Have you ever dreamt? Did you ever dream that you would have your name on a wine label?
Never at all, you know. The thing is that Red Red Wine was such a massive hit for us. It went to number one in England and all over the world in 1983. And then 5 years later, it went to number one in America, you know, so it had sort of two lives. And that's why it's really the song that, you know, everybody thinks of when you say UB40.
Absolutely. And I remember sort of jumping around and jiggling around to this a long, 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 long time ago. But it still seems a really fresh song to me.
Yeah, well, there's no sell-by date on good music.
I like that.
That's a great expression. It's funny, I was doing the research for this morning and I immediately got the song stuck in my head. And I didn't realise that it was released in the year of my birth in 1983. Wow.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's how long we've been playing it, you know.
It's incredible.
And we didn't write it, of course. It was written by Neil Diamond, but nobody was more surprised than us to find that out. We knew it as a Tony Tribe sort of rock steady record, you know, from our youth.
I actually love it. Can you just explain the sort of thing about having some wine and getting into that? Is it really useful for promotional purposes? Are you finding it helpful?
No, it's not really for promotional purposes. It's because we thought, you know, why don't we have our own wine? Since, you know, our most famous hit is called Red Red Wine, you know, it's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, it's about time.
And Eminent Life came to us, you know, and said, could we collaborate and get involved in the, you know, approving the wine and blending it and tasting it and approving it before it got bottled, you know.
You're not going to say no to that, are you? I bet there's a few tastings going on.
I mean, I was a barman back in the day before the band, you know, and we used to clean the pipes and, you know, spend all my time drinking all the different wines and that. So it's something I was used to doing. And we came up with a great wine, you know.
And you guys were instrumental in the actual development of the combinations and the flavours and stuff like that?
Yeah. We had a few tasting sessions and stuff. And, we do travel the world and have been for sort of... I've travelled all my adult life around the world and we've stayed in some of the best hotels in the world, you know, and we do drink a lot of wine, as it happens.
I love to hear it.
So, it was fun to get involved, you know.
That's great. Okay, so if anybody wants to know about UB40 and any of the tours that they have or anything that they're doing, they just need to go to ub40.org. And I wish you a whole bunch of luck with this wine. And also, we hope the tour continues to go well, Ali, and love your music.
Well, thank you very much. Big love to everybody out there. And hopefully we'll meet someday and we can quaff a little red wine.
That sounds like a blimmin' good idea to me. Thank you so much, Ali. Bye now. We have as a guest Paul A. Young, who's a chocolatier. What's the French way of saying that?
Chocolatier.
Chocolatier.
It's sexier, isn't it?
Oh, reminds
chocolate. Chocolatier is like a chocolate ear.
A chocolate ear. Reminds me of a film I once saw.
Chocolatier.
Oh, that's a good film, that is.
Yeah, it is a good film. Yeah. So let's just talk a little bit about you. So you've got three shops in London, Soho Bank and Islington. And you are pretty much renowned, really, for being a groundbreaking, inspirational chocolatier, which I'm going to use that word.
Nice.
You've got a reputation, I think, of real incredible creative flavours.
Yeah,
You probably consider yourself as an alchemist in a way.
Yeah, I was very lucky and very privileged to be in the first year we opened the store to be named as like an alchemist or someone. The Sunday Times said it had some Blumenthal of chocolate. Because at the time, you could go to every chocolate shop and buy a praline, a caramel, a champagne, the same things. And I was just so frustrated that there was nothing really innovative. And I just thought, we're seasonal in the UK. We've got great ingredients. We've got brilliant micro distilleries, breweries. The chocolate doesn't come from the UK, but what can are the ingredients? And I just admit, I think it was about after 6 weeks, I realised that some of the standard things weren't selling. And that was the point.
That you realised. In a way,
yeah. And I was a product developer before that. So I was used to saying, yes, we can do that. And I thought that was something London didn't have. Fresh, unpreserved chocolates with real ingredients. So if it is strawberry, it's real strawberry. But then I thought, well, strawberry's been done forever. What else can we do? Well, if you add Pimm's to it, and then Pimm's has mint and cucumber in, and that became...
So it's real flavour combining for you.
Yeah, my chefs are making recipes. You can make chocolates by buying compounds, flavourings, ready-made reductions and powders and things. That's okay. But for us, it's not okay because we want absolutely fresh is best, pure, unpreserved. They are 7 days. You've got to eat them, enjoy them.
I'm glad you said that because you've given me a box of chocolates here and I have to eat them now.
You have to eat them right.
So I've got a box and I've just opened it. It's beautifully, beautifully packaged.
Looks like a book.
And it's called a book box.
Like a book. So you open it, looks like a book. And in front of me, just calm down. Hold back a minute. In front of me are 16 beautiful chocolates to look at, let alone taste. And they're all sorts of colours and shapes. And some have got little like crushed nuts on and different
gold
shapes.
Gold or something
there's
in there.
Gold
as well.
And there's
Well,
some
chocolate
are red,
is brown.
Some have got fleckles on.
So you have to make it colourful.
Right. Now, you have got no clue as to what these are.
No, so I thought if you want to pick one, I will tell you what they
are. Okay, right. So I'm going to pass you over to Hub. I can't because he's almost...
Can I
grab you one? No, you can't take the box.
No, this is not possible.
Just pick one.
And I'll tell you what it is.
And then Paul will tell you what it is.
The only issue I can see is that there's only one of each. So if you find one that you really like, you can't have a second one.
Then you come back for myself.
So describe that.
Hub has just picked up calamansi, which is a Malaysian citrus fruit. This has been on our collection for 11 years. From day one, and it's a great summer chocolate. It's acidic, fragrant,
Hub's face.
Full flavoured.
Hub, please say
makes
something.
Your mouth water.
I can't wait.
He's having.
I want
to
save at the moment.
I can almost hear you. So I can hear you salivating from here.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to go for this little guy. It's like a half circle.
Now. It's very light.
It's very light. So. Yeah. A lot of chocolates, if they're full of glucose, syrup and fats and things, they'll be chewy and hard and they'll be claggy. We don't want that. You want crisp, clean flavour and texture.
Yep. No, it's lovely.
So,
Guy, what have you got there?
Guy.
So I've got this kind of half circle, like half a sphere. It's kind of pinky, red, purpley in colour with some gold flecks on it. Yep.
So this one...
What are we looking at here, Paul?
You are looking at... So I'm the UK California prune ambassador. And this is
he's a man of many titles.
I knew this program would be bomb champion.
It is. I don't know how it happened, but it did. Anyway, this is ambassador. we've oak smoked California prunes, and we've made a caramel with malt, and then put bourbon in. So it's a smoked California prune, malt caramel, and bourbon with a 38% milk chocolate from another brand I'm ambassador for, Guittard Chocolate in San Francisco. So the chocolate we use on the outside is milk chocolate made with grass-fed cow milk from Humboldt County.
Let's just do this the rest of the show. Just seconds 60. And thirds. Come on.
We might not talk about it.
I don't care
at all. You don't care? Okay, fair enough. And yeah, how does it taste?
Oh, it is good. So smooth. So and it's got like a liquid centre as well.
It has very soft. So there's only one chocolate you have to have, which is in the corner. It's a dark dome.
Tops now.
This one.
Yeah, this is okay, the first chocolate I ever developed.
Okay, so
14 years ago, the recipe hasn't changed, and this is what started the business.
Okay, so this just looks like a dome of chocolate.
It does.
Doesn't look particularly.
It's not decorated.
Exciting.
Not decorated. Okay, then.
It's understated.
Can
just
I just
like
tell
Paul.
You? I had a filling that fell out this week.
Oh no!
I've got a dentist appointment tomorrow. This may well kill me. You might have to drag me off the ceiling. okay.
Do I talk? So I'll tell you what
Paul
is
going to talk.
It's a 64% Madagascan shell. Full of sea-salted caramel, and I entered that 14 years ago into the first Academy of Chocolate Awards, and it won a gold. And it's won the most awards in the chocolate industry so far for sea-salted caramel.
Sue
and it's our biggest
fainted.
Seller, and without it, we wouldn't have the business.
Oh, wow. Well, when did you start?
When did you start? 14 years ago was when I started working and developing chocolate. I opened the first shop 11 years ago.
Okay,
now,
okay.
I generally like chocolate that much at all. I'm not
sacrilege, you can't say
not,
that.
I said okay, not okay, that much at all. Unless they're very, very good quality, which you don't get very often. So I've just bitten into that. So there's a hard crust of chocolate on the outside. I know the studio's a little bit hot anyway. Yeah. I've just bitten into that. And then I just got a little wave of this liquidy ganache type chocolate with beautifully balanced salt in it, I would say, and caramel. Oh, gorgeous.
Thank you.
Blooming good. I wasn't going to eat anymore, but should we have some more?
Yes.
If you're listening and you're bored, I'm terribly sorry, but it's far more important that we try these.
Should have been here shows.
If you want to follow along, pause and go and get some chocolate and then come back. And you can join in.
I'm not going to just grab one.
I'm going to grab you. You have to have this one because I can tell you what's something a bit more unusual.
So can you describe what it looks like? That one that's just just dark.
It's a piece slab. Of chocolate.
Tiny dark slab.
Tiny dark slab with a bit of colour on it. I'm very bad at describing chocolate.
This is a caramel, but there is something cooked into it which creates a sensation at the back of the throat.
Mm. No, it is. Told me I was going to be here.
Do you know
poor
what?
A. Young.
You so got the a good straw, didn't you, to come today? No. I mean, you could have been on next
it's
week's
hard to
show.
Compete,
And you've arrived on the show with Paul.
Mm. We get to go pack it so, every week.
So that one hub is a tobacco caramel. So we've cooked American, it's obvious, it's American tobacco into the caramel, and it gives a tingle of the nicotine at the back of your throat. And it's a lovely, long, lingering, rich flavour.
Mm. Again, but the very softness is that it's like that not lingers, but in a nice way, you know, it's not sticky or...
Mm. That's it, can eat more.
Yeah, exactly. Well.
I've got this one that looks like, you know, those like cornflake things you make
when
you're a kid and you get cornflakes.
I love
Rice Krispies. And you come. So it looks a little bit like that. What have I got here?
So this is a Madagascan chocolate rocher. It's got sea salt, pecans, hazelnuts and almonds. It's one of my favourite chocolates. It's crunchy, textural, and it's nostalgic because most people like, if you like nuts, like roasted nuts with chocolate. Again, being on the collection 11 years, can't take it off. It's just it's a classic.
We probably should have checked if you're allergic to nuts before we gave you that one, shouldn't we?
Yes, I'm just about to dive an anaphylactic shock.
I think
nuts, and you can tell those are pecans.
Yeah, I love pecans.
The problem with, I think, walnuts and cooking walnuts, sometimes they're a little bit sour.
They're bitter, yeah.
These are really lovely. And what's interesting is the salt isn't in the chocolate. The salt is somehow in the nuts, which is really, really nice. And actually, that wasn't too chocolatey. It was very nutty.
So, Guy, you've got something really
I've
special.
I've got one.
A new one.
It looks, if I was to describe the shape, it's a little bit like a Rolo. You know, kind of like obviously that is sacrilege to say here.
It's a kind of a flat disc.
A flat deep disc. That sounds much better. But there's like a, some kind of etched into the top of
cocoa
it.
Pod.
Looks like a cocoa pod or a cocoa bean. And it's kind of dusted with this kind of bronzy goldness.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to eat it.
This is... Four Pillars Gin from Australia.
I've
done well here.
Yeah, why haven't I got that one?
It's a good one. With cucumber, grape, pink grapefruit and coriander seed.
It's quite, you're looking so smug.
How many chocolates do you have? Do you know every chocolate exactly?
I've still developed them all with my production manager Nick, and the three production teams make them.
How many total do you have?
Chocolates or people? Chocolates. There are 24 individual chocolates on the collection at any one time. We change half that collection every 6 weeks. Within the store, there's up to 150 products because we have brownies and bars and lots of hot chocolate, ice cream.
And you must have to make them very, very regularly because they have such a short shelf life.
Yeah. Every day. Wow. The team are great.
Can you describe that gin one?
It is amazing.
Bearing in mind, you wouldn't let me have any. So the second best thing is for me to hear what it was like because I'm not going to eat one.
This is the problem with this box. There's only one of each. Really interesting. I mean, normally I wouldn't say that, you know, chocolate and something quite savoury like gin would go together, but it just has that kind of little spiciness that cuts through. I mean, I guess chocolate and spice is a well-known thing.
Yep.
But really, really interesting.
Can I try this one? What is that?
That's lemon tart. It's so clean,
is it?
Yeah,
it looks like what does it look like?
It's coated in sweet pastry, so like
it almost looks like it's covered in breadcrumbs. Actually,
it's covered in pastry crumbs, very buttery pastry crumbs, and inside is just clean lemon. It tastes like a piece of tarte au citron.
Good. Hub one more. We better end this and talk about you in a minute. Otherwise, we're never going to get round to your products.
I'm going
to
go for it.
I love that. Shall I pick you another? Let's go for something.
Lemon curd.
This one is very, very seasonal.
Oh,
this is totally on trend right now in terms of the season, and it's a scone, strawberry jam, and clotted cream.
Oh, really? Oh my god!
I've never seen anybody enjoy themselves quite so much as you, Hub.
I'm used to hear you guys explaining things. Wow, that's so well explained. All I can do is sit back and
I don't know if we're great at explaining things. We're really good at eating stuff. Yeah,
we're good at
eating. Drinking things.
I like eating things.
I would say the lemon. I quite like the fact that. The lemon wasn't a surprise to me because you just described it.
Yeah.
What was a surprise is almost like you've got this almost breadcrumby coating.
Yeah.
Which has got a really nice texture around the outside.
It's important to have different textures because chocolate is generally a texture and a crispness and a smoothness, but you have to break it up and so that doesn't become one taste and one texture. Mm. I'm going to give...
Can I have another one? Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Which one would you...
This probably isn't making a very good programme.
we have. In the box, we only have
all
two.
Very happy.
We have eight left. And
one more, guys. That's all. And then we'll have to eat them in the break.
So alcohol or no alcohol?
Alcohol, please.
Oh, pass that round, please. That was very quick.
It's very, very, very quick. Well, I didn't want Guy to have this one.
I can't have all the booze.
There we go. So see if you can guess what that is.
Oh, God, here we go.
Oh, we have talked about it briefly already.
I'm going to guess champagne.
It was champagne.
It is. Just champagne and chocolate.
Amazing.
Nothing else.
I loved all of those. I loved having them on the show, and I hoped you enjoyed listening to them all over again. Thank you so much to my co-presenters, Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs and Guy Routledge of The Food Rush. Don't forget, you can download our hundreds of podcasts from foodtalk.co.uk. And we'd love to hear your thoughts via Twitter on @foodtalkshow. And I look forward to talking about all those things food in 2018. In the meantime, I sincerely, really sincerely wish you and your family a happy and food-filled new year, and that you have a restful Christmas break. Bye now.